Knights, Mason, Mike, hanging out with you on this Thursday evening. Thanks so much for spending time with us. If you want to holler at us, 98973 is the State Roofing text line. It's a great way to get involved in the conversation we're having here on the show. Mike, we talked a little bit last night when the news broke that the Cinerama looks like it is, in their words, going to be closed indefinitely.
Correct.
And a tragedy that is to the culture of Seattle and folks who would come from out of town to come in to experience the Cinerama. It was a really unique and wonderful place.
It was an event theater. I mean, it was where you wanted to see certain films, and that was your, you would wait to see it, to go see it at the Cinerama.
Absolutely. No question. So as we were combing through the internet earlier today, I saw an article in GeekWire at geekwire.com that asked the question, should Amazon buy the Cinerama? And so here to perhaps answer that question, I don't know if it has an answer, but we're going to get to it, is GeekWire co-founder and friend of the show, Mr. John Cook. John, thanks for hanging out with us.
Thanks for having me tonight.
John, it occurred to me when I saw your story about Amazon and should Amazon buy the Cinerama. At first glance, I think, like, wow, that seems like a great idea. I mean, as long as it's saved for my benefit, right. I don't really care who owns it. But the other thing I started thinking about is Amazon weirdly going to take the place now for Paul Allen, who was buying things, and people would get sort of like, well, just ask Paul Allen. We'll just ask Paul Allen. You know, yeah. these great local things that were going to go under. And Paul was just enough, had just enough nerd in him and geek in him to want to buy these things, mm-hmm. and prop them up just for no other reason than his will and his own interest. He's gone. Are people going to be now looking culturally for that person to step up and buy the things that we can't afford for ourselves?
Well, you're right, Mike. I mean, you know, those have been around the Seattle area long enough and remember the Sunset Bowl, which I know is special to you and to me both. But I remember that discussion when the Sunset Bowl was going to shut down. Oh, well, let's get Paul Allen to buy it. It was this common refrain in Seattle. And as odd as a personality that Paul Allen was and as eccentric a billionaire as he was, to his credit, he invested in a lot of interesting projects around Seattle that added to the cultural landscape in really creative and interesting ways. One of those being MoPOP, one of those being Cinerama, the Living Computers Museum. And you see Paul Allen's touches throughout the entire city, much more so than you see it from other billionaires. For example, Jeff Bezos or Howard Schultz or Bill Gates, of course. And so this was an interesting development this week. And to answer the question of the column that I wrote on whether Amazon can step up and buy Cinerama, I don't know. I mean, I think it's going to be an interesting discussion and debate on whether they come on board and go through with something like that. There's obviously some political challenges for an Amazon to step in and do that. And historically, they just don't have the same sort of quirky culture that Paul Allen had in the city.
So let's say you get 5 minutes in front of Bezos to do a PowerPoint presentation to convince him why Amazon should buy the Cinerama. What would some of your slides look like? What would be some of your points?
Well, first off, I think Jeff Bezos hates PowerPoint. So how about this? What if I said, we'll put it in Amazon speak for our Amazon listeners out there. Let's have a two pizza meeting. This is famous cultural lore at Amazon that you got to have every meeting. It should be enough to feed feed people around the table with two pizzas. So we'll do a two pizza meeting with Jeff and talk about this. You know, I actually think Amazon is trying to engage more in the community, and there's certainly, I mean, a community engagement and a PR element to this that would just make a lot of sense. A lot of people in the community love Cinerama. It's a cultural icon. It's a special part of the city. A lot of people have a lot of fond memories of it. They should just do it because it's the right thing to do and step up. But I would actually probably make the business case to Bezos, and I think there are a lot of business reasons why this makes sense for them. one being just pure location. It's right across the street from their main headquarters, and they have been expanding rapidly in that area. And they need, at least up until COVID-19, they've needed additional space for employees to have meetings. So you could imagine, you know, from 8 a.m. to 4 p.m., this being a pretty interesting space for folks from Amazon to meet, just as this as the spheres are today. You know, they invested a lot of money in making the spheres this pretty interesting new cultural icon. So why couldn't they just preserve Cinerama? The other thing that's pretty interesting with Amazon is the fact that they are expanding, as we all know, very, very heavily into digital entertainment and streaming. They have an extremely fast-growing entertainment business where they're creating a lot of original content. So a venue like Cinerama could be used in many ways to actually showcase that content in unique and creative ways. You can think of red carpet premieres or doing just interesting things for employees.
There are rumors out there about them potentially buying the AMC theater chain?
Yep, absolutely. That's another element of this. They're already apparently showing some interest in expanding into the movie theater business, looking to potentially shake that up. And so last month, the shares of AMC skyrocketed on some of these rumors. And these rumors have floated before. Nothing obviously has come of it. But who knows in this environment whether that's possible or not.
John, what about the way that this was presented to the public about the Cinerama closing? It seemed like it didn't even announce that it technically was for sale. It essentially just said, we're closed for a while, maybe forever. See ya. And it wasn't really that we would like to find somebody else to take over the Cinerama and we would like to see this thing preserved for Seattle. It was sort of a weird, kind of flat, disinterested, pandemic. We don't want to deal with that anymore. What do you make of that?
It was odd. I have the same reaction and odd timing as well. This isn't the time for the philanthropic groups of Seattle to be pulling out of the cultural icons that have made the city great. And so I was really surprised by the timing, the way it was communicated. There could have been a strategic reason for it, and that perhaps they were actually kind of floating it out there to see if anybody did want to step up, if any community groups come together, any nonprofits come together, any billionaires come together that may want to step up and take a piece of it. So I was very perplexed by the timing and the way this was communicated, and really kind of a shame because, you know, Paul Allen did leave a pretty interesting legacy here in Seattle, and one could argue had pretty important touch points that he's made on the city. And so to see something like this only a couple of years after his death, kind of the rug being pulled out from under it, it's just, I don't know, I think it's leaving a bad taste in the mouths of a lot of Seattleites.
Well, and it also seemed to me that, and again, I can't say with any certainty, obviously having never seen the books, but it seemed like there was a disinterest from the Vulcan group in this prior to the pandemic. The way that they kind of suddenly announced a shutdown where, you know, the staff has to go, we're doing this vague remodeling that we don't know when it's going to. I mean, that's not even the way you handle a remodeling plan. If you're remodeling a big institution, let's just say it's a Space Needle, you tell everyone, we plan on like fall of whenever, this is when it's going to be open. We're looking forward to seeing you back here again. It was the same sort of tepid announcement that this one was. It was like, it was like somewhat a kid that got tired of a toy and then just walked away from it more than it was someone actually worried about any level of legacy for something like the Cinerama.
I agree with that, Mike. And I think, we talked about this on the GeekWire podcast, which we just recorded. And this was the point of Todd Bishop, my co-founder, that the wheels were already in motion here.
Right.
And that this was something that they were going to do anyway, even after Paul Allen's death, when his sister Jody took control of the estate. they had mentioned that they were going to start to potentially shed some of these assets. And so Cinerama, the Living Computers Museum, a lot of these things were kind of in jeopardy. And you were hearing things about the entertainment group at Vulcan and about how it was potentially going to be, you know, pivot or shut down, or something was happening there. And obviously the new direction of the state didn't want to have some of these assets that Paul had supported and accumulated throughout his life. My point on that was, you know, it's one thing to have three mega yachts that you might not want, you know, right. You might just want one mega yacht. But if you have something that is embedded in the cultural fabric of a city, I don't know. To me, it's different. You know, it's like there's one thing of selling assets and you don't want to manage it anymore, but there's other things that are really special and unique to the city that I think there's a higher responsibility that comes with those assets. And I would put Cinerama in that group. I'd put the Living Computers Museum in that group. It's a not as well known, but really unique facility. And they make Seattle what Seattle is. And I just would hate to live in a city where those sorts of things aren't supported by some of the richest people that live here.
We're talking to John Cook. He's the co-founder of GeekWire. John, when we were talking about this yesterday, I couldn't help but sort of ask the question, is it irresponsible of us, or what do we do when we lean so heavily into the preferences or the whims or the inclinations of one, let's call him odd billionaire, right? That we have all of this stuff because there's one guy who really liked it. And now that guy is gone, and it seems like this stuff is up in the air.
Yeah, and I think there are challenges with that. Hopefully, there's the infrastructure and support and the money to keep some of those ideas going if people feel they are important to the larger community. And so, you know, I hear that. I think if you look at a city like Pittsburgh, where the Steel Barons, you know, help support universities and cultural institutions, I mean, some of those institutions are running today based on that money. So, I mean, it's like hundreds of years it went on for. And so I guess that's why it's a bit disappointing that it's only lasted a couple of years. And believe me, I'm not a believer that our billionaires should come to the rescue of Seattle and we should become just billionaire USA. And that's all we care about. And, you know, I know there's a big worry with that, with even if an Amazon were to take over a Cinerama. But my larger point here is, especially in this time, especially with the troubles we're facing in the economy related to the pandemic, especially with the state of downtown Seattle being the way it is, and with many of these large tech companies perhaps not going back to work in the same way they are, I would hope we as a community here in Seattle can come together as a business community, a nonprofit community, and work together to save the cultural icons that make the city what it is. And we cross the aisle, so to speak, to make things like this work. There's enough, you know, you got to put the political squabbling behind us, and we got to get back to trying to rebuild our city. And it's going to take a lot of different people to do that.
Is there another billionaire in line behind Bezos who might also be interested in something like this, or is it kind of Amazon or no one?
Well, I should say we should differentiate between the billionaire money of Bezos coming in and supporting it and Amazon coming and I actually think there is a business case that Amazon should just come in and support it because of the reasons I laid out earlier. I mean, it's in their business interest to do this. So I think there potentially are other people, other community groups that could come together. You know, we saw this with KNKX down in Tacoma, where there was a giant community effort to save that public radio station. And, you know, I'm hopeful that a consortium of folks could come together and maybe it's led by one very wealthy person, or a group of wealthy people with additional support from the community. No one immediately comes to mind. I'll have to put my thinking cap on who has a real deep passion for film and cinema. I'm sure they're out there.
Well, what about the idea that, I mean, let's look at the trajectory of KEXP, right? Started with a lot of donations, primarily funded. I think Paul Allen was a part of that as well. And then it managed to work itself into being one of the most popular radio stations in America by virtue of the internet, but also its own fundraising juggernaut. It is one of those entities that has its own capacity to raise its own money and stands largely independently. I mean, it gets big benefactors from time to time, but nonetheless, it does its own sort of thing. I mean, should maybe some of these institutions, with a little push from somebody, actually establish themselves independently? And wouldn't that also be a preferable thing in Seattle?
Yeah, and I do think there's value in having a consortium of folks come together to build something out like Cinerama for its next generation, hopefully. And so you can imagine something like a Seattle International Film Festival involved or other organizations like that. And so I think that would be the ideal situation, frankly, and turn it into, you know, we're recreating, and I mean, we're going through this massive period of disruption in the economy, and I think there's an opportunity to think about what the movie theater of the future looks like and use Cinerama as the test bed for that. And I think there would be a lot of interest in that specific venue and with the history there and in the space that it locates in downtown to hopefully come behind an idea like that.
So did you hear anything back from Amazon?
No, I did not. I heard back from some other downtown Seattle leaders, some who said they thought it was a fantastic idea. So who knows where this will play out. I mean, I would think if it's actually for sale, and I mean, Amazon would at least have to think about it and take a look at it. The one challenge here is just, I think, and you know, you've talked about this story a lot, but there's just such a toxic environment right now in Seattle as it relates to Amazon. And I don't even know if Amazon could politically pull this off, which is where it gets a little bit disappointing, you know. Even if they wanted to, I don't know if you know, people would really rally behind them to make this happen.
John, were you a chocolate popcorn guy?
I was not. No, I'm a straight up old school popcorn guy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mike, were you into the chocolate popcorn?
Of course not.
Not you guys. Now look, I will admit,
chocolate's great. Popcorn's great. They do not need to meet and marry.
I will admit that a whole thing of chocolate popcorn was a lot, so that's why you got to get the 50-50 mix. Solves all the problems. I'm just throwing that out there. In case we get to experience it again, that's a pro tip from your boy on the chocolate popcorn.
I hope I get to give it a college try next time I'm down there.
I hear you. That is John Cook. He is the co-founder of GeekWire, geekwire.com. They have a podcast. Look for it wherever you get podcasts. John, thanks so much for hanging out with us, man.
Yeah, thanks, John.
Thanks for having me.
We'll be back with more Cairo Nights right after this. Welcome back to Cairo Nights. Mace and Mike hanging out with you on a Thursday evening. Thanks so much for listening to the show. If you want to be a part of it, shoot us a text. 98973 is the State Roofing text line. It's that simple. It's that easy. Just holler at your boys. Mike, you're a bikeman, I believe is the technical term.
Cyclist?
A cyclist. You're also a motorcycle man.
I like two wheels.
If you say cyclist, are you also including motorcycle riders?
No. Okay. Cyclist generally just refers to bicycle. A motorcyclist refers to a motorcycle.
Okay. Rider. And then biker, it just has its own aesthetic.
Yeah, biker is sort of a subset of motorcyclists. Generally speaking, not really. I mean, some people, you'll hear them use that sort of casually for meaning cyclists.
Mm-hmm.
But generally speaking, if you say biker, you're sort of thinking of a very specific thing.
Have you ever seen the movie? Oh, this is so stupid. The movie Super Troopers?
Yes.
There's a scene where two people are meeting covertly at a restaurant, and the woman is sitting down, and she's at a table, and she's got a leather jacket on, and her hair's all tussled up. She's got that kind of rough look. And then the other guy who called the meeting comes in, and he's got, or he didn't call the meeting, she did. Anyway, he's got spandex shorts on and a big teardrop helmet.
Yeah.
And the sunglasses, and he just skin tight clothes, and he looks at her, and he looks at himself, and he goes, "Biker, I'm an idiot." That's one of those scenes that just pound for pound makes me laugh unnecessarily. But the reason we're talking about this is because bikes, I wanted to talk about bikes as a means of transportation, as a way to navigate a city, or especially when you're talking about the COVID times that we're living in. You know, people are afraid to take transit for risk of getting ill, that also ride shares and getting in cars with strangers isn't necessarily the greatest idea, or at least some people are worried about doing that kind of thing. But if you can hop on some sort of a bike or a scooter or an individual vehicle that can take you from point A to point B, that seems to me like a great idea.
Yeah, it appears that we're in a bicycle revival right now in this country. If you look at the sales data, I think that nationally, sales associated with bikes, that's both bicycle repairs and bicycle sales, are up 44%, which is substantial from last year. The people who are buying electric bikes in particular, going through the roof right now, if you are selling electric bikes. I don't have sales data for Seattle. I suspect, given the number that I see out on the road, that the sales are at least going reasonably well in this town. Certainly no one is fighting to get out of the business. Now, everyone's sort of taking a little bit of a hit based on just convenience of walking in, shopping for a bike, riding that bike around, deciding if you like it. But when I went to, I just dropped off both of my bicycles, which are not electric bikes, but regular pedal bikes, at Ascent Cycles in Ballard. There were people dropping them off the entire time I was there, and they had a backlog. You're going to wait for a week and a half for your bike to get back, which is great. I mean, I don't mind it at all. That's not a complaint. I love seeing busy bike shops because it's a tough way. The margin is narrow, and it's a tough way to make a living. But bike shops would tell you that the bikes, particularly the ones in the affordable range, like $1,000 and below, are selling like you can't keep them in stock. People are buying a lot of bicycles. The bigger question is why. I think there's a couple of things going on here. One, you would think that driving is actually easier now because the traffic is so minimal.
Right.
But I think that people also, because they're working from home and finding that they're doing a little shorter distance, a bicycle is a pretty appealing thing. I think actually you find, and most cities would, most places would tell you that, the way you get more cyclists is you create some form of grade separation between them and regular traffic, because a lot of people aren't really comfortable in traffic. I've done it long enough. I'm reasonably comfortable in traffic, but if I have to pick, if I get a place where I have a designated bike path that's not filled with walkers or a road, I'll take the bike path 100% of the time. I mean, it's a safer environment. You can't always account for every, you know, driver looking at their phone, right?
Right, right.
But I think that because of the traffic is less, people feel a lot safer cycling. And I think they're finding that, wow, this is a pretty easy way to get around town. If you are on a decent electric bike and you want to get, say, from the University District to Pioneer Square, it is, on any busy day in Seattle, a normal pre-pandemic day, the fastest way to get from point A to point B. And this includes every other form of transportation short of a helicopter.
For sure.
But even without the cars around, it still is reasonably quick. I mean, you could probably get there on electric bike. Again, that's electric bike. Let's just say you can do 18, 20 miles an hour. You could still probably get there within 5 or 10 minutes. And I think people are realizing that this is actually, when you reduce traffic and when the fear factor drops for those who are not comfortable out in traffic on their bicycle, they find that it's a pretty easy way to get around. And in Seattle, the reason I bring up electric in particular is hills.
Yeah.
And people like the assist. When I'm slogging my way up a hill, and I have always have that kind of, you know, John Henry moment where where the steam-powered shovel comes past me, when somebody on electric bike is going uphill faster than I was going downhill.
You're sitting down.
Yeah, and it's just, it's always frustrating. But on the other hand, as a cyclist, the more cyclists on the road, the safer you are. The more people out there who are, when motorists are seeing it as a regular part of the traffic stream, the safer you are. And aside from the texters who may or may not be cyclists and who may or may not have angry texts about jerk cyclists.
Sure.
I want to tell you before we go any further, I agree with you.
Yeah.
I see a lot of cyclists do really dumb, stupid, mean things, and I feel like that affects the entire cycling community. I see just as many, if not more, motorists doing that as well. So I get you, and I agree, but I like the idea of more people on a bike, because even if you're in a car, it still is better for you to have fewer cars out there.
Yeah, well, what happened to the electric bikes? The ride shares that we had here?
So I think that, well, Jump is still around. That's the one owned by Uber, and I've used those quite a bit. They're super convenient. They actually are not bad bikes. The electric assist is kind of nice.
It is nice.
So those are still around. Lime was supposed to be coming back. I don't know. Post-pandemic, everyone's pre-pandemic plans have modified into a post-pandemic what if.
Yeah.
So I don't know what's going to happen to them. But I hear that there are other electric bike companies that are thinking about it. But I think what also is happening is that you don't need to borrow one if you ride one regularly and you take it directly to where you're going. My guess is that what people really need now is better lots for locking them.
Mm.
Because an electric bike can set you back $2,000,
right,
or $1,500.
Right.
Now you're in the price of a lousy car, and you want to be able to keep that more protected than a simple U-lock will do for you.
Yeah, you get in that Dutch game of how many locks can I have on my bike? Because the Netherlands, Amsterdam in specific, is an incredibly bike-friendly city. I've been there a few times, and they're just everywhere. They have their own lanes. It's really the primary form of transportation in the city.
Is. Yeah, absolutely.
And so there are bikes everywhere, and any Dutch person will tell you because bike thievery is an issue, but they'll say the more locks you have, the better. That if you have four locks on your bike and the bike next to you has three, the thief is going to go for the third, whether or not it's actually, effective.
And so your question about the bike companies is a good one, because we went from having more bike companies than any other city in America to going down to one. And that one, we don't know how long it's going to. I mean, are the Jump bikes going to do well? I don't know. I don't see as many people on them.
Agreed. We'll be back. More Car on Ice right after this. Welcome back to Car on Ice, everybody. Mace and Mike shutting another show down on this Thursday evening. We're joined, as always, by Mr. Frank Shires and Mr. DB David Burbank. It's time for What's on Your Mind. You can tell us. We'll tell you. 98973 is the State Roofing text line. DB, you want to go first?
Yeah. It's going to be very underwhelming. I don't really have a ton to say other than I am currently, for the moment, for a brief moment, I'm driving this old Ford, I think it's an F-250, maybe F-150. I don't know. It's from
truck?
The... Yeah. It's an old hunk of junk truck that my girlfriend's dad had for years. And so he's letting me drive it for the time being just because my girlfriend's schedule and mine don't line up. I'm coming all the way from Woodinville. It's a whole thing. But anyways, it obviously does not have a CD player or like an auxiliary input or anything. It just has a tape deck. And I have a bunch of old cassette tapes from one of my previous cars that I have not been able to use in months and months. And so I broke those out today.
Yeah.
One of them is specifically like British hits from the 60s, like British Invasion stuff. And it just felt so good tooling around today this afternoon.
Cool.
In the sun, listening to, the Kinks and stuff like that. It was just great. Made me feel real good. So sometimes when you have an old piece of technology like that, you really appreciate how
stuff.
Little, or even just the old stuff of how limited your selection is.
Yeah,
and songs that I might skip over in my iPod or my iPod is it, in my Zune. Things I would normally skip over, I can't skip over. And so I listen to them, and because of that, it imprints in your mind, and then all of a sudden you have a better feeling about a song, maybe.
That's cool. How about you, Mike?
Back to the time that before they'd killed the album, that's actually
right.
I know. I agree with you. I miss that all the time. What I was thinking about actually is, unfortunately, not anywhere near as light. The eviction stuff we're talking about really concerns me. Having been in a family without a lot of money and having been in that situation myself, it is awful. It is really the worst possible. I mean, you worry about health and all of those things, but not having any shelter at all, everything else that you value, really, your relationships, everything unspools from the lack of shelter.
Yeah.
And so I sincerely hope that there is some relief for folks who are facing that. And if you're listening and you're getting close to that, you know, my heart goes out to you, because it is an awful situation to be in. And we're going to be running into that. You think it's bad now. We're going to be running into that regularly come June and July. And I certainly hope that the powers that be can create a situation, which at whatever, I'm not political about the solution. I just want to make sure that there is a solution.
Yeah. My dad, when I was young and he was still living in the house, my parents were still married. He was a pilot for Eastern Airlines, which went out of business in 86, 88, something like that. And I know we didn't have a lot of money. I don't know how close we came, but as an adult, I should ask my mom, because she's not the kind of person who would have talked about that kind of thing anyway. She's pretty, you know, closed about that kind of stuff, and that's fine. But man, you know, I think back and realize how many people came over and brought us food. How many folks, you know, would be outside doing work on the house, like friends from church and all that, and how she was working like three jobs at one point. Things that don't really register with you when you're that young. But I'm gonna figure that out. I've been thinking about that, and I'm gonna give her a call. How about you, Frank?
You know, I don't have anything as profound as that. I got out in the sun today. I took the dog, Rosie, who is almost eight now, a yellow lab, to Marymore. And I just was watching her today, and something struck me that I don't know if you guys appreciate this or not, but I have a decoy that I threw out for her, and it's the tall grass right now. So all the grass at Marymore is probably 2 feet high.
Mm-hmm.
And this lab, when you throw a decoy or a ball out into the tall grass, have you seen a deer jump through the brush?
Yeah.
That's what she does with her ears flopping, tail straight up, jump, jump, jump. And I thought as I was watching that today, I got to mention this because it is such a beautiful sight to see that animal just happy and doing what she instinctively knows to do.
Yeah.
It was a beautiful thing to watch on a sunny day.
That's cool.
Did she find the ball?
In fact, she's trained to go. If she loses it, fine. And then she'll mark back and forth.
No kidding.
We had a Belgian Shepherd when I was a kid. Best dog we ever had. She lived to be 17.
Wow.
Three times in the field near our house, and I'm not exaggerating. Three times when my dad threw a ball out in the field, she brought back a live rabbit.
Whoa!
By the scruff of the neck. This dog was astounding.
That is amazing.
Wow.
That really is.
Well, that's it for us, everybody. For Mike Lewis, Frank Shires, DB, I'm Aaron Mason. Thank you so much for listening to the show, and we'll see you all tomorrow. I know they don't sound the way I